I am the architect. I created the Matrix.
Shall we play a game?
Before we start today's show, I want you to know this is an hour-long podcast. It is a new segment, one I think you will enjoy thoroughly. In this segment, I'm going to interview Kansas Democrats, maybe a Kansas Republican or two, but they will all be what I call millennials, young men, young women who are between the ages of 20 and 40, well-educated and critical thinkers, and people that in many cases will provide information that's contrary to my views, but it's a new segment. Now, today's segment, I'm going to be talking with a young millennial who I'll introduce in a few minutes, and I'm going to go over the following issues: net neutrality, how he feels about it. What about Trump's executive order travel ban? Will the Supreme Court uphold that ruling? Does he think the media is fair for Trump or biased? What is the young millennial's opinion about the Senate's health bill? Is it a good bill? What about Obamacare? What do young millennials think about the MSNB assassins, as I call them? Is there anybody fair on TV? From Chris Wallace to O'Donnell to Chris Matthews to Tucker Carlson to Rachel Maddow, etc. I'm going to ask this person his opinion on the polls. Do they make any sense? Are we going polling crazy? And then where does this millennial find the truth? Is it on TV? Is it on radio? Is it on the internet? Where is the truth for young millennials? And finally, I ask, will Trump survive the next 4 years? It's an hour-long podcast. I was going to break it up into separate sections, but I realized that the flow is very important. So you may want to listen for 10 minutes, go back and get a cup of coffee, and come back and listen for another 10 minutes. But I'm not going to break it up because it's too important a podcast, and plus it's a new section. So with that in mind, thanks for listening, and off with the show, or on with the show. Good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are. This is June the 21st, and you're listening to webtalkwithbob@gmail.com. And as usual, if you have a comment or a question, whether it's positive or negative, please feel free to email me at webtalkwithbob@gmail.com. And do I have a treat for you this evening? I have with me one of the most famous millennials in the heart of America. Somebody that we found in Kansas. We've looked around, and sure enough, we found a Kansas Democrat. And his name is Brian Frankian, and I'm going to be asking him some questions. I've already spoke with him for a few minutes. He works in a high-tech company. He's very familiar with politics. He has a political science degree. He went to the University of Kansas, which is a thing that he and I have in common. So, Brian, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's going to be exciting to talk to you. Now, do you have anything on your mind right now? Any current event that's bothering you that you want to let our listeners know about?
Well, no current event that's bothering me, but of course, we just had our special elections in Georgia, which, you know, don't seem to be a great omen for the Democratic chances of retaking the House. There are 23 congressional districts where Democrats won, or Hillary Clinton won the majority of the votes over Donald Trump, where the Republican won either re-election or election to the congressional district. We're actually sitting in one of those districts. They need 24 seats picked up to retake the majority, and it doesn't look good right now because they were looking at that congressional district in Georgia to do it.
Well, Brian, that's a great comment, a great observation. Do you think Nancy Pelosi will hold her job because of this? She's 77 years old, a big money raiser, but I heard she helped raise $20 million for that guy down there.
It was the most expensive congressional campaign in the history of the country. I don't know that Nancy Pelosi will ever be sitting in the Speaker of the House chair ever again, but I don't think she's going to lose her position. She's well-connected in the Congress, and there's very little chance that they're going to try to oust her. The question is, how are the Democrats going to recruit candidates that can win in Republican districts? John Ossoff was unelectable in a conservative district, didn't even live within the district, had never held political office, was, you know, was pro-choice, was anti-gun. How are you going to win in a southern district with those views, even if you're trying to make the election about Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is unpopular in the
Well,
district.
Sure. On top of that, is I understand that what they did, what the Republicans did, is they ran a lot of ads connecting Pelosi with, what's his name again?
John Ossoff.
Ossoff, yeah. All right. Which to me, I mean, if you go much east of the Mississippi, you realize a lot of people don't have respect for California. They in California are pot-smoking liberals out there, and Nancy Pelosi leads the pack. So the Republicans probably did a pretty smart thing. I mean, they didn't run on Trump, really. Mm-hmm. They ran on Pelosi's as a negative campaign, right?
Yeah, and the Democrats tried to make the election a referendum on Donald Trump, but it simply wasn't. It's a local election. The things that matter to people in local elections isn't who the president is. It's not some grand political scheme of how are we going to put a block on the president. It's who's going to take my interests to the Congress. And obviously the people of the district decided it wasn't John Ossoff.
What a great thing for the advertising business there. There can't be more than 100,000 people in that district, right? So if you spend $50 million on a campaign, what's that, $500 a person or something?
Yeah, they said each vote was going to cost the candidates
$100. $100. Oh, my God. That's incredible. You could have just bought the votes. Probably a lot of people would vote for you for $50. Okay, so that's pretty good, and that's certainly current. And I'm with you. I mean, I think Pelosi is probably on her way out. And even though it wasn't a referendum on Trump, because they didn't bring up Trump that much. Of course, Republicans now will definitely take the position that it was a referendum on Trump and Trump won, right? Mm-hmm. And all the Democrats that I've read articles on so far all say the same thing. Well, we almost won. It was a trend. We're getting closer, right? But I'm like you. I think the problem is that how do you get good Democrats to win? And as you point out, this guy's not even in the territory that he's running from.
Yeah, he wasn't, and it's a problem that we're going to have as a Democratic Party, because you look at our congressional district that we're in right here, Congressional District 3. It's a district that Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump. It's a district that Kevin Yoder, the Republican congressman, was reelected resoundingly over a very flawed candidate. If we can't find a good candidate in a district that Hillary Clinton beats Donald Trump, how are we going to find good candidates in districts, the districts where Donald Trump won by a narrow margin, but the Republican congressman won by wide margins?
And I'll come back to that in a few minutes, because I think that is a great point, and that is where are leaders coming from? We know that our universities can produce great liberals, but as soon as they get a job and start paying taxes, within 15 years, they become Republicans. I've seen this before in young people that I know. So we know KU is a great producer of liberals, and the University of Chicago, a great producer of liberals, and many people then move away and then become Republicans. Okay, so let's move on here. A topic that I get asked a lot about is net neutrality. Are you familiar with it?
I am.
And do you have an opinion on it?
I do. I'm in favor of net neutrality. I don't believe that we should be allowing the corporations that are controlling the internet. Oftentimes, folks living in areas where there's only one internet provider, it may be Comcast, it may be Spectrum, but there's one internet provider, and we don't need a backroom deal between Netflix and Comcast in order to provide extra speed for them at the expense of an Amazon Prime or a little guy's website.
So you think everything is pretty fair right now on the internet?
Well, I don't know that coverage in the internet is fair, but right now we've got a very open forum on the internet, right?
We do.
So anybody can go out there, produce a website, produce streaming video, produce a podcast, and have it downloaded at the same speed as a Netflix, somebody who's streaming a Netflix movie.
I mean, you believe that's true, what you just said.
I do.
Do you have any evidence that that's true? Do you know that's actually happening?
I mean, of course not. Of course we don't know that that's true.
Well, do you often take positions on things that you don't know if it's true or not? Is that a Democratic thing?
Well, are we going to open it up and say that we're going to remove the regulations that say that you can't do that, right? Just because we can't just because I can't prove, and I'm no technical wonder boy here, just because I can't prove that it's flowing at the same speed doesn't mean that I don't want regulations in place that say it has to flow at the same speed, so that when we catch somebody who's not allowing the internet to run at the same speed for everyone, that we're able to go after those folks.
And who would enforce those regulations?
Well, right now it's the FCC.
They would enforce those regulations. Do they have regulations now?
I believe they do.
Are they enforced?
Well, the question is, have we found anybody that's violating the regulations? Well, I don't know if they're actively, I don't know if there are any active investigations attempting to identify folks that are violating that.
Well, let me ask it another way. Presuming that we just came on the scene, Brian, you and I together, and somebody asked us about net neutrality, but we didn't have a preconceived opinion, who would benefit from net neutrality? Who are the beneficiaries of that?
The primary beneficiaries of net neutrality are smaller companies, smaller folks, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to be an up-and-coming vlogger, or if you're trying to produce a streaming audio off of your own website as opposed to using Apple's podcast product, right? Those folks are the ones that are going to be hurt by not having net neutrality. Because
would Netflix benefit from net neutrality?
Netflix would.
Would Google benefit from it?
Netflix likely actually would not benefit from net neutrality, nor would Google, because they're corporations that have the money to go out and invest and pay Time Warner, pay Comcast, in order to make their services
faster. Does it strike you as strange that both Google and Netflix are in favor of net neutrality?
It doesn't, because they're the sort of the liberal technology companies, right? And it's
so
very
you
much
think they're in favor of it because they're liberal.
Well,
and that's not because of their shareholders.
I think they're in favor of it for the same reason that Exxon is in favor of climate change regulation. They see the writing on the wall. They see what's coming. They understand what the future of their product and their world is. And for Exxon, it's not oil. And for Netflix, it's not having to pay Time Warner Cable to speed up their service.
So your argument is that net neutrality helps the small business. And even though it's a negative, in your opinion, for Netflix, they, in their altruistic liberal viewpoint, are in favor of it.
Well, they may have also done the analysis to say, it's going to cost me a lot more to bribe Time Warner and Comcast to speed up my pipeline to consumers than it's going to cost me to not do that and have my service be a little bit slower than it could be.
It's my understanding that Netflix is a major user of the, let's say, the size of the pipe, the delivery of the information. And they want to protect their right to deliver that video to you and I and make their shareholders a ton of money, which they can do as long as they don't have to pay more for it. So their position is, I don't want AT&T or any ISP have the right to charge me for using something that they've spent $30 billion developing. Now, the ISP, Sprint, AT&T, they're $20, $35 billion in debt because they built the highways. Why shouldn't they be able to control who rides on that highway?
I disagree with the concept that it's not a utility. How do you operate in this world, in the United States, without internet coverage? Most folks can't.
Well, we did for 100 years,
right,
or
but,
more.
Well, we operated without email, too. And if you walk into any office building and say, hey, I'm going to send you a fax, they'd look at you like you had six heads. They'd say, well, why don't you send me an attachment on an email? It goes twice as fast. It's easier. I don't see folks being able to operate in the United States, continue to make money, continue to educate themselves without free access to the internet. And by free, I don't mean you don't have to pay for it. I mean open access to the internet.
So in other words, let's say I am Sprint, and I happen to know approximately Sprint as an ISP paid is $25 billion in debt, building out, call it the highway system, right? In other words, Sprint owns it. And as a matter of fact, in many cases, they paid license fees for the right to own it. So now that I own it, now I spent $25 billion of my own shareholders' money owning it and building it. You, as a consumer, want the government to step in and say, Mr. Sprint, we know you're $25 billion in debt and having a hard time staying alive, but we want to now control what you own. Isn't that against fundamental concept of capitalism?
I think that you could certainly argue that, and I think you're doing a very good job arguing it. But you could argue the same with the power lines. We regulate electricity, we regulate gas, we regulate people's access to water. Mm-hmm. What I would disagree with is your position that Netflix and Google should be paying Sprint and AT&T and Comcast. That's why they have end users. That's why they have consumers who pay for their service. They should be charging the consumer for consuming the internet, which is what they do, not charging the people who are generating the traffic. And really, when you look at it, the reason there's traffic is because people are going to it. People are using it. Sprint should be ecstatic that there's a Netflix and a Google. Time Warner should be. Comcast should be, because people are using their services. They're finding value out of the services, which means they're going to continue to pay for those services. And if they can get faster service by upgrading from 18 down, 1 up to 25 down, 2 up, then they're going to do it, because that means faster delivery of their service.
Okay, let me bring you back to reality for a second, Brian. Let's assume you're the president of AT&T, and you have shareholders who have invested millions of dollars in your company, and you've taken big risks. You've hired people from across the United States to go out and build these huge towers and build this pipeline. So now you're at a shareholders meeting, and you're saying, next year, we're going to probably lose money because we spent $30 billion building a pipeline, and your government is now telling us we can't charge people what we want. Now, we're always fair. I'm talking to my shareholders now. We're always fair. We don't ever overcharge to the extent we can, because it's not a monopoly. We compete against the other ISPs. But we should have some rights to charge the big guys like Google more money, because after all, Google now is worth more money than all the automotive companies put together, worth more money than AT&T, right? Last year they did $75 billion in sales, and all their sales occurred on what? Our pipeline, the pipeline that we built. So if you're a shareholder of AT&T, or you're the president of AT&T, how do you respond to that?
I would respond to it the same way that you just did, and it was a comment that you made that really triggered in my head. Was they're saying we can't charge people. Nobody in net neutrality is saying you can't charge people. What they're saying is that you can't charge the companies that are producing the content. You can charge the end user whatever you want. You can charge the end user. I don't know what your cable bill is.
Interesting.
I don't know what your cable bill is, but mine's about $150 a month. They're certainly getting their money off of me.
So you'd be in favor of, although earlier you were in favor of protecting the highway system, if you will, the electronic highway, for the small person. Now, when this small person wants to sign up with AT&T, I could charge them $1,000. You'd be in favor of that.
Well,
you'd say that's right.
You could, but who's going to pay AT&T $1,000 for internet service?
Well, AT&T say, I don't have enough room. Either pay $1,000 or don't do it, because I've got all these other people using it. I'm just saying, it seems like to me you want both sides of it. You want to protect the small person, yet you want to give AT&T the right to charge the small person anything they want and let the market determine what's a reasonable number. But in the other case, you don't want to let the market determine a reasonable number for the content providers.
What you said there is a little confusing to me. Are you saying that we need to be regulating what the service providers are charging the end user?
Just the opposite. I believe there shouldn't be any regulations. I'm against net neutrality. I believe the ISPs should be able to charge what they want, right? If they want to charge the content providers a premium, because after all, the highways work like that. The people that use a lot of the highway, like the truckers, they pay extra taxes to keep the highways up, right? The people like you and I, we don't use a highway that much. We pay a lower tax rate. So the highway system, to me, is analogous to some degree to the net neutrality system, because the highways now are the electronic highways. The difference being, and this is the big difference, the highway systems, the I-70s, the I-35s, were built with federal dollars. And so any car can drive on it, a Ford or a Chevy, right? But if General Motors would have built their own highway system, it's for damn sure they wouldn't let a Ford drive on it, because they'd spent too much money. So the highway systems were built with federal dollars, and we should all have federal access to it. But not so for the electronic highway system, which were built by shareholder dollars. And I am fundamentally against, and I hear your point on neutrality, but I'm fundamentally against anything where the government steps in and says, oh, you've built such a successful system. It works so well that now we're going to say we got to regulate it. And to me, that is a big detriment to people starting businesses, because if you become big, if you become successful, if you spend billions of dollars building this new electronic highway, the government's going to step in and say, and now we're going to determine who you can charge for that.
Well, what I think where our fundamental disagreement is you're seeing it more as a highway system. I see it much more like the high line electricity that's pumped in. And if we look to Texas as an example of how to operate in a quasi-regulated environment, we can look to their utility companies in Texas, which have been deregulated, but which still certainly fall under minimum standards within Texas for how to deliver electricity safely.
Brian, you're a very, very smart young man. I really appreciate your input on net neutrality. We don't agree, but I can see where we do have some differences, and I see some area where we could agree if we probably had a lot more time. Let me switch to another current issue, and that is what's in the papers every day, Trump's executive order on the travel ban. And we know that it's been in two courts. Both courts have overturned it, saying it's not legal. He doesn't have the right to do it, and it's going to go to the Supreme Court. Are you in favor of Trump's executive order on the travel ban?
I am not in favor of Trump's executive order on the travel ban. I think that it does quite a bit more harm than it does good. We just had a tragic incident in Flint, Michigan today where an immigrant from Canada stabbed a police officer outside of a terminal at the Flint, Michigan airport. A travel ban
that
is not...
That was Trump's fault?
No, that's not Trump's fault, but a travel ban isn't going to protect anybody from somebody coming over from Canada. If we look at the countries that are on the travel ban list...
Are you suggesting we should include Canada?
No, I'm not suggesting we should include Canada. I'm not suggesting we close down the borders because there's...
So you would just let anybody in?
Well, not anybody, right? We still have a visa process. We still have a process by which people are screened as they get onto planes and as they come to the United States as tourists, as permanent residents. That's an even more stringent check. I think we've had the president call it enhanced scrutiny. I think that's certainly valid. And we should be reviewing folks that are coming from any country to ensure that they don't hold extremist beliefs. And we shouldn't be targeting
Somalia specifically.
And how are
we going to do that? What five questions would you ask somebody? You're in charge. This person comes in front of you, and they say, I want in the United States of America, in some form of broken English. What do you ask them to make that determination?
It's not a question of what do you ask them. It's a question of what does your investigation reveal as we're talking about allowing people to immigrate into the country. This isn't a tourism ban, right? It's not. This isn't somebody saying you're not allowed to come into the country for 2 weeks and take snapshots of the Empire State Building. This is, you're not allowed to come and immigrate as a refugee, or you're not allowed to come and immigrate.
So you're in favor of investigation?
Absolutely.
Now, okay, so let's take this hypothetical person. How do you investigate them? What do you do?
Well, as any of us who have gotten, who've become employed here recently and, in the last 10 years, you go through most companies put you through a background check. They make sure that you don't have criminal records. So they make sure that you're not being...
So let's take a hypothetical person, and you find out that they have no background information. The country they came from only knows that they live there. They don't have income. They don't have any history. They don't have any work history. There's nothing to investigate. What do you do with that person?
What if that person's coming from Germany or England?
Okay. He's coming from Germany. Now what?
So are we going to ban immigration from Germany as well?
Well, let me ask it another way. Here's my understanding of what the executive order really says. It really says, if you come in from a country where we cannot investigate you, vet you, which is what your suggestion, which I agree with, where we can't vet you because that country doesn't have an acceptable vetting process. We can't find anything out about you, right? Then we need you to not come in, or we need you to force your country to establish a background check process that we can, in fact, check up on you. So going back to your example of Germany, they have a vetting process. You can actually find out a lot about German citizens because Germany, like America, spies on all their people. They collect information just like we do, right? So now coming back again, that I agree, it sounds like you agree that we should investigate them. And what do we do when we do not have a vetting process in the country they come from? What do we do with that person?
Well, it's simply false to say that there's no vetting process in that country. People leave trails, people leave records of themselves, even when they can't be investigated through the means of the foreign government.
So you recommend we hire somebody to go into that country and like knock on these people's neighbors' doors and say, does Mr. Smith do here?
Well, we have a State Department for a reason, right? And oftentimes these folks, so what we're talking about here is a ban from seven nations. Many of them are unstable. How do we guarantee? So we, all right. Let me start over here.
Well, it's a tough
right.
issue.
We're talking about a ban on from seven countries, right? Many of them are unstable. There are dozens of other unstable countries in the region, right?
I guess, right.
Countries in Southern Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa.
These are countries that were identified by the Obama administration as supporting terrorist activity. That's what I understand.
They were identified by the Obama administration as areas where there needed to be enhanced scrutiny. I absolutely will agree with you there. That is undeniable. There are, if we want to talk simply about how do we understand, how do we know that somebody that we're allowing into our country is not going to be a threat to the country, how are we doing that in Rwanda? How are we doing that in...
I don't know. How are we doing
We're not. But there's no travel ban against Rwanda. There's no travel ban against Central African Republic.
So you would recommend that we expand the travel ban?
Well, we either need to apply the ban uniformly or we need to not apply it at all.
Well, I think that's a good point. So you would be in favor of expanding the travel ban to include every country that has no acceptable vetting process inside the country.
That at least makes sense. That at least makes logical sense.
God,
right
Trump
now,
would, Trump would love you for that.
Right now, what we have is we have seven handpicked countries that happen to be predominantly Muslim. We have a court system that said you can't really call it a travel ban. We have spokesmen for the president coming out and saying it's not a travel ban. It's not a travel ban. It's enhanced vetting. It's enhanced security. It's not a ban. It's not a ban. And then we have the president undercutting his own argument by going on to Twitter and talking about a travel ban. And we have a Trump supporter here who's undercutting the Trump argument by calling it a travel ban.
And I agree with everything that you're saying because I see those same things. But let's talk about the executive order for openers. Does a president of the United States have a right to issue an executive order preventing people to come into the United States? Does he have a legal right to do that?
Yes, I happen to disagree with the court's decision.
So he has a legal right to do that. And in the executive order, even though we may not agree with the countries, and we may agree it's maybe applied unfairly or it's applied irrationally, let's say, there's nothing wrong with the legality of the executive order.
I would agree. I would agree with that.
Now, have you ever heard the term pretextual justification?
I have not.
Okay. And I've not heard it a lot, but I have heard it because I've read both of these opinions from the courts. And what their argument is that even though the Trump says or the Trump spokesman say the executive order, the ban, is not a travel ban, it's not a restriction on Muslims entering the United States of America because Trump has tweeted, because Trump has said other things prior to this executive order, They use a term called pretextual justification. That means that I know what you said, but what you said is not what you meant. So I'm going back to look outside the four corners of the contract and look for intent. And in my opinion, the judge in Hawaii and the judge in, I think it was the Fourth Circuit, maybe it was the Ninth Circuit, said, it's clearly your intent. You don't like Muslims, and you're not letting them in the country. So even though the executive order doesn't exactly limit Muslims, because there's lots of countries, a lot more Muslims, and those countries were okay not mentioned, right? So pretextual justification says that we're going to have rulings that go beyond the four corners of the contract. Now, I, by the way, I'm a four corners of the contract person. I believe if we get in trouble for intent, there's a lot of people are going to be in trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, Hillary Clinton got off because she didn't have an intent to do something wrong. So I think there's an area there that we could agree on too. But here's another point. Why is it that some critical thinking can't be applied here between the Republicans and Democrats and come up with an executive order, just as you said, that's more rational, that makes more sense, and is not looked at by Muslims as a Muslim ban? Why can't that be done?
Exactly. And that's actually why I oppose the travel ban. It's not because I think it's illegal. It's not because I think that we shouldn't be vetting folks that are coming into the country. It's that it is applied in such a way as to make it appear as though it's strictly a ban on Muslims. And that is...
Well, that's horrible.
Well, that's fodder. It's absolute fodder for ISIS to go out and recruit folks. It's bad application of what is potentially a good policy.
Yeah, when you realize also there's a billion Muslims probably in the world, right?
And there's maybe 1,000 that want to do us harm.
Right. Although 1,000 kind of worries me. But, okay, one more point, and maybe we'll take a 5-minute break, because I think we're going to get enough content here for a couple of different podcasts. Do you think the Supreme Court, this issue is going to go to the Supreme Court, do you think they will uphold the lower court's rulings or overturn the lower court's rulings?
I think that had the president not shot himself in the foot with all of his tweets regarding it as a travel ban, mm-hmm. it would have been smooth sailing through the Supreme Court. They would have absolutely overturned the lower court's ruling. It would be the law of the land. Now, I don't know that it's not going to get overturned by the court, but he's certainly made it harder on himself by tweeting out irrationally at 5 o'clock in the morning, we've got a travel ban. We've got a travel ban.
Well, I appreciate you going on record with that, because speculation and prognostication is the most difficult things of all. I'm going to say that the Supreme Court is going to overturn the lower courts. And even though they do that, they're going to rewrite the executive order. And I think it's going to be a difficult one for Gorsuch, because people are going to claim that he was the swing vote. And I think he's going to look at the four corners of the contract. He's going to say, here's what the executive order says. Intent, we can guess all day on intent, but legally he has a right to do it. He did it. If Congress doesn't like it, they can pass some legislation to overturn it.
And I think you're right, and I think it's probably silly that we look at... Yep. I think you're absolutely right that people are going to look at Gorsuch and say he's the swing vote, which is a little silly. He's replacing Scalia, so he's really not swinging anything one way or another. But as the new kid on the court, he's certainly going to be looked at as a key vote.
It's going to be some wonderful... I don't know if you're like me, but I love to read Supreme Court opinions. They are so well written. And this is going to be a great one when it ever gets to the Supreme Court, but it may take a year. Now, jumping around, let's talk about the media. You know how Trump thinks. Trump thinks the media is against him. They're assassins. Do you think the media has been fair to Trump?
I think that the media started out thinking that Donald Trump was a joke, that his candidacy was a joke, that it wasn't real, that it was this sideshow. And I think that that opinion and that view of the media was very unfair to a presidential candidate. He's not the guy in New York City who says nothing but the rent is too damn high. He's a serious candidate for president. And the media really dismissed him initially as somebody who couldn't win, was irrational, had no policy positions, and really, I think, reported on him unfairly in the beginning. After, when the president started coming out with policy positions that folks weren't happy with, when he's tweeting things irrationally at 5 o'clock in the morning, and the media covers that, it gets construed by some supporters to say this is being unfair to the president. I think there are some folks that have done a better job than others at remaining remaining neutral and remaining fair to the president. I know you're not a fan of MSNBC, but one of my favorite folks in the news is Joe Scarborough in the morning. And I think that that his show, Morning Joe, has been exceedingly fair to the president. They've had him on numerous times. And the coverage of the president has been very fair, I think, by Mr. Scarborough.
Brian, I have to tell you how happy I am to have you on this podcast. You are obviously very smart. You have critical thinking. Okay, you're a Democrat. But I hope that people like you, young men like you, that are smart, bright, and have a political interest, will run for office. I hope you run for office in Kansas. If you do, I want to be able to support you. Because people call me a Trump supporter, and sometimes I am, but mainly I like certain policies, and I hope he gets some of those policies through. But I don't call myself Republican or a Democrat. I'd like to consider people like us to be just critical thinkers, that we want to come up with the right solution for whatever the problem is, whether it's an executive order or whether it's net neutrality, and that we want to be part of the discussion. So I hope you run for office. Are you ever thinking about, do you ever think about that?
I initially, you know, obviously when I was going to school studying political science, it was certainly something that I had thought about, but I have no interest in running for, certainly not high office. I do have some friends locally who have actually run for and some have won seats in the Kansas House. So, you know, all the best to them
Well, I hope you do run. I hope you do run, because I think one of the things that concerns me as someone who's not a millennial is that I wasn't more active as a young person in politics. Although when I was at KU, I was an absolute liberal. I went to Wisconsin as a representative for KU for the Students for a Democratic Society. There was 8 candidates from all of KU. I was one of them. So I was very much a liberal in those days. But I'd rather think of myself as being a critical thinker as opposed to a label, because there's a lot of things Democrats and even what's his name, what's the guy that's always on gets mimicked on Saturday Night Live?
Oh, Sean Spicer.
No, not him. The Democrat that ran for president.
Oh, Kerry.
No, not him. The other guy, the older guy. He wanted universal education.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. I actually think a lot of things Bernie says were correct. I'm in favor, for example, of if you can get into college, you should be able to graduate. If you can stay there, it shouldn't be a situation where only if you have enough money. College is way too expensive, and there should be a way that we can get every smart person, anybody that can get in there and stay there, should graduate. I'm very happy that the larger schools, Stanford and Harvard, now are basically tuition free. If you can qualify, they have enough money now where you know, if you're very wealthy, you're going to pay a wealthy price. If you have no money, you're not going to have to pay, because otherwise, I don't see how we can get all our smartest people through college. It's too expensive.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems that we see, especially when we talk about college, is Americans want a fair shake for everyone, and everybody wants to start at the same point, and we want to get everybody starting at the same point. We want to say go and let everybody run their race and win or lose of their own merit. And unfortunately, with the system that we have today, there are folks that start out well in front. You know, I never had to worry about how I was going to pay for college. I had a head start when it came to higher education. There are folks that I work with now, they're the first in their family to go to college, and they were fortunate enough to get financial assistance because they couldn't afford it otherwise. There are folks that I worked with years ago when I was getting ready to go to school, working in the grocery store, in the meat shop, that couldn't afford to go to college and were more than capable of doing it, more than qualified to go to school, and they simply couldn't afford it. They were too wealthy to qualify for economic aid, but they were too poor to pay for it out of pocket.
I understand that 100%. Okay, Senate's health bill. What do you know about it? What do you think about it? What kind of health system are you in favor of?
Well, the Senate health bill's a little bit of a mystery right now. I don't think anybody knows anything about the Senate health bill. There were Senators Mike Lee in Utah, Ted Cruz in Texas came out and said, we haven't seen it. They're supposed to be on the committee that's writing it, and they haven't even seen it. I do find it ironic that Democrats are running around with their hair on fire screaming, we haven't seen it, we haven't seen it, we don't understand what's in it, when just a few short years ago, we were doing the exact same thing. And there are Republicans, again, I find it very ironic, that are defending the way that they're trying to push this healthcare bill through when in 2008, they were running around with their hair on fire saying, what do we do? Nobody's showing us this bill. So I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides as we've talked about the Senate health bill.
The problem that I see is one of a practical problem. Let's say we want to write a health bill, and there are six of us. So we circulate it, ask everybody to redline it. Well, we can pretty well control that. It comes back. It's got red line, blue lines, and gray lines. Let's say we ask 50 people to look at it. Well, now we've got 50 different emails. We've got 50 emails going to each person. So now we have a much different problem. Let's say we want to bring in 100 people or 200 people. Now we got 200 red lines. Some people are changing colons, mm-hmm. and some people are redlining whole paragraphs. Some people just aren't agreeing with it at all. And then all of these people have got lawyers in the background that they're paying to check out and write the legalese. So if we expand the number of people that can write it too early, I believe we never get it done. I'm in favor of 20 people writing it, or 25 people, some controlled number, and then you distribute it, and you get your comments, right? And then maybe there's several iterations, but I don't think you can expose hundreds of people to that kind of language, the language, what I call legal language of a health bill, and get reasonable feedback.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely. Everything that you just said, I happen to agree with you. I think the problem is we're starting out with 12, and in reality, we're starting out with fewer than that because three of the senators who were supposed to be on the committee writing it have said they haven't seen it yet. The speculation is that it's being written in the offices of Mitch McConnell, which is fine. Absolutely. Start it out there. Write it there. Bring it to the wider audience of 12. Let them redline it. Then bring it to the wider audience of the Senate and let the Senate debate it and redline it. The problem, the crux of the problem, isn't how it's being written. It's that we've had the Senate majority leader say he needs this through before the July 4th break. And I agree. We should be very cautious about anything regarding healthcare. We're affecting we talk about it as a healthcare bill. In reality, it's an economic bill. We're talking about a bill that's going to affect 1/6 of the U.S. economy, and we're trying to get it pushed through in a matter of 2 weeks.
Do you think Obamacare was effective?
I think that Obamacare was an attempt at reforming a broken system, and it got it 75% right.
The healthcare issue for me is very complex. It goes beyond what I can even think about because it deals with issues of, well, how you pay for it, because that's fundamentally what it's going to come down to. It's a matter of cash. We want to provide healthcare for more people than have healthcare now. So who's going to write the check? I see a lot of people that are in favor of expanding it, but I don't see those same people in favor of putting up the money. I am a big believer in, if you're in favor of something, get your checkbook out and write your check on it. And if you won't want to write your check, if you just want to complain about it, then you don't have a right. Now, so coming back to the healthcare bill, let me ask you a specific question. Do you think it's important that we have this whole notion of pre-existing condition in a healthcare bill, where the insurance companies are forced to provide insurance to you, even if you have a pre-existing condition? Do you think that's a good idea?
I do think that's a good idea. In a country as wealthy as ours, we shouldn't be keeping people from health insurance that have a pre-existing condition. And when people think about pre-existing conditions, they're often thinking about somebody who may have a terminal illness already, or somebody who has a rare, expensive illness. Oftentimes when we talk about pre-existing conditions, or the majority of folks that get hit with things like pre-existing conditions are people who may have had a child that's considered a pre-existing condition in some places. That's where I think we start to get into the territory of ridiculousness.
So you think that in the area of pre-existing condition, there should be a lot of categories. Let me be specific. For example, do you think the insurance company should have to write insurance for someone who has terminal cancer and has bills of chemo bills of like $200,000 a year, and they want insurance? Do you think the insurance company should have to write that policy?
Well, I think this is where it gets interesting and where I think Obamacare started down the
now,
right.
Is that a yes or no question?
Well, it was, and I'm gonna answer it. The issue that I see here is that, and where Obamacare tried to address it, is in order to get the insurance companies to be able to afford to cover folks with pre-existing conditions, they needed people like me, healthy 29-year-old male, to pay into the system. And while I'm not going to pay a lot, they need me to pay into the system. They need 100 of me to pay into the system in order to cover folks with pre-existing conditions. And where I think I think Obamacare really got it wrong was it didn't incentivize folks like me to go out and get insurance. I think that's one area where the Affordable Care Act really missed the mark. People are smart. They're going to do the math. They're going to say, it's $1,000 for me to get insurance, or I pay a $695 fine.
So you should have had to pay, you'd have been in favor of if they'd have forced you to pay or go to jail or pay $5,000. And why should you, a 29-year-old, pay for the person that's got cancer? Maybe they've got lung cancer and they've been smoking for 40 years. They know smoking's bad. They smoked anyway. I mean, you have to write the check for that?
Well, and those folks paid a higher premium throughout their life because they were smokers.
Maybe they didn't pay any premium. Now they want to get insurance because the Obama has said, hey, you've got to have insurance now. As they cough.
And that's pain now, but it's positive later, right?
So but you're in favor to say of that, paying the bill.
I am. And it's penny wise, pound foolish, because you have to start somewhere, right?
But you're not in favor of paying the bill. If it started to hurt your pocketbook, whereby you couldn't make your car payment, you wouldn't be a favor of taking care of that person that has cancer, would you?
Well, I think that's not a fair. I think that's not a fair sample, right? I'm not in danger of not being able to pay my car bill because
I
have an
insurance
bill. But if
you were, would you still pay for that person's insurance?
No.
Right, and that's the answer. I think that's the pragmatic answer. Is that all of us are willing to contribute some, but we don't want to give up our own lifestyle for the other person, even if they have cancer. Now, the other thing about this pre-existing condition is that the other difficult thing for me is, although the insurance companies have to insure you, there's no requirement for how long or how much. I'll insure you as a pre-existing condition, but you'll have a $50,000 deductible, and it'll only be for 6 months, and after that, your payment's going to be $2,000 a week. So there's no requirement. So how do you enforce the pre-existing condition on an insurance company that doesn't screw their shareholders?
It's very, very difficult. This is not a simple problem to solve, and it's why it's been the poison pill in politics since Hillary Clinton tried to get it done in 1993.
Why can't we just have a single payer system?
I have to believe there's an easier way to do it, because if you look at other countries, they seem to be able to figure out how to pay for folks' pre-existing conditions.
Why can't we just have a system whereby if you're sick, you go to the doctor, it's all paid for by the federal government, which of course we're paying for anyway, taxpayers. As a taxpayer, I believe we're paying for health insurance anyway for the hypothetical person that has cancer.
We are, and it's incredibly expensive for us to do it right now, because folks that don't have insurance coverage, they're not going to they're a primary care doctor. They're not even going to specialists. If they get sick, they're going to the emergency room. And that's incredibly expensive for everybody else.
And we pay that too.
We pay that.
They can't turn them down. So are you in favor of what I'll call a single payer system? And I'm giving you an example of what I mean. I'm on Medicare. Medicare, I can tell you, works unbelievably well. Now, I pay for it. I pay about $200 a month. But the website where I go to get information about Medicare is great. They push information to me. They say, dear Mr. Sherwood, you didn't get your annual physical. It's covered by Medicare. Go take it. They give me a list of things, things that I could get covered. So the system, and there's 50 million people on Medicare, and the system for me is the website, the way when you go to doctors. I mean, I know there's some doctors that may not take Medicare, but everybody that I go to, and I go to good doctors, they all take it. Why can't we just go to Medicare and say, look, hey, sign up for Medicare and expand it, because the system is already in place, the coding, the payment, et cetera.
I'm going to surprise you. I think if I sat down and thought through it really well, I would love that solution. But there is something about a single payer system that just doesn't sit well in my gut. And I don't know
you're
what
not
that
a true
is.
Democrat.
Apparently not. It just doesn't set well with me.
You're just
me.
3 years away from becoming a Republican, Brian.
I'm not entirely sure why it doesn't set well with me. I think one of the big problems that a single payer system solves is the opacity of the system, which is you try to understand what a knee operation is going to cost you before you get your bill. It's virtually impossible. And you could get it done at one hospital for a certain price, drive 2 minutes down the street, and get that same procedure done for a quarter of the cost. It's the opacity that it
you've nailed
eliminates.
It right here. And that's the people that are against it are the hospitals, particularly the for-profit hospitals, even the not-for-profits, because they realize that somebody might put out a number that says knee operations, they're $2,500. I don't care what city you're in, it's $2,500. But now I sound like maybe a Democrat, but that's the one thing about Bernie Sanders thing that I'm in favor of it, because in principle, here's the principle for me. We have 400 million people. We're one of the richest nations in the United States of America. Everybody should have health care. So if you can't afford it, go to the doctors and you get taken care of. Now, that doesn't mean you eliminate the private system. If you're a multi-billionaire and you want to hire your own doctor to travel with you on your G550 around the world and you can afford it, go for it. But the rest of us who cannot do that, then we pay. For example, I pay $200 a month. My wife will be on Medicare here in about another 7 or 8 months. She'll be about $150 a month, much less than the $500 we were paying last year with a deductible that we're never going to hit. So that's why I'm in favor of it. But above that, what I keep coming back to, and this may be a simplistic view, is that remember all the trouble we had with Obamacare? They couldn't get a website up where you could enroll. The Medicare enrollment takes like 2 minutes. And in another 2 minutes, you have your own portal to your own site that keeps track of everything you're supposed to have. I mean, it amazed me when they said Obama paid out like $600 million to some Canadian company to put up this website. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't they just take Medicare and do some sort of a redirect? Because that website works.
Yeah, the whole rollout was an absolute disaster, and I don't think you're going to find anybody on either side of the aisle. Yeah. I think if you asked our illustrious former governor, Kathleen Sebelius, who was in charge of the rollout, she would say it was an absolute utter disaster.
It had to be embarrassing for her. Okay, now, you know that I am of the opinion that MSNB are paid assassins, that basically they're after the 4 or 5 million people that watch them. They're after big contracts for advertising, because today it's all about eyeballs. Advertisers control. I have never watched Rachel Maddow or Lawrence O'Donnell say anything good about Trump. I mean, do you think MSNBC is unfair to Trump?
Well, I think that the late night folks, right, the Rachel Maddows, Lawrence O'Donnells, even some of the earlier time slot folks at MSNBC, like
Chris Blank.
Chris Blank.
There you go.
I think that those folks are spouting opinion. And it's on a news network. I think it's very similar to the folks at Fox News from the Obama years the Sean Hannity's and Bill O'Reilly's spouting very conservative rhetoric to their followers, and they're four or five, or really it's Fox News, so it's quite a bit more than that, 5 or 6 million followers or eyeballs that are watching the screen at any given time. I don't condemn the whole network. I know I said earlier, one of the folks that I really respect in media right now is Joe Scarborough. And he's on MSNBC, former Republican congressman.
Well, he's about to be fired from Florida. If he starts saying things good about Trump, he's probably going to be fired.
I think he was one of the few people that was genuinely fair to Donald Trump from the get-go. And I think that his program and him in particular, he was one of the few people that really were looking at his candidacy and going, this guy could win. Even when everybody else was going, yeah, he's at 25% in Iowa, but that's his ceiling. Yeah. And then the next day it was, he's at 33%, but that's his ceiling. And then it was, he's at 40%, but that's his ceiling. They never bought into that.
What do you think about Mr. Hardcase, Chris Matthews?
Chris Matthews.
Right. What do you think about Mr. Hardcase? Hardball with Chris.
One of the very few exchanges that I have ever actually watched on Hardball was his exchange with Zell Miller in 2004, when Zell Miller challenged him to a duel at the Republican National Committee. So I can't say that I watch his show. I can't say that he's in the same category as Rachel Maddow or Lawrence O'Donnell. But I certainly think he's got a left wing slant, and I think that that his program bills itself more as a news show, and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell really build themselves as opinion folks.
I think Chris Matthews is a big bully. I watched him the other day. He had two very nice people on his show. One was a young lady who was clearly intimidated by him, and he would ask her a question, but before he let her talk, he would give her the answer he wanted. And he would look at her with, you know, he's a nice looking guy. His blonde hair is over, and he talks really fast. He's extremely articulate, persuasive. He looks like he knows what he's talking about. So he asks her this question, and he kind of ends with what the lawyers would call a leading question, because he says, now, you agree with that, right? You agree with what I just said, right? I mean, after all, you're on my show, and I'm paying you to be here. You agree with what I just said, didn't you? That's how he does it. He's a bully. An articulate, nice-looking bully. He's been around for years, but I've watched him simply intimidate people on his show to agree with what he says. In court, if you ask a question to someone, if you say a question, and then you say, you agree with this, don't you? That's called a leading question. It's not allowed in court, under most conditions of cross-examination. But he's a bully. Okay, let's move on a bit. I got just a couple more things, and we may just, this is such an exciting opportunity for me. I love talking to you. You're so bright. You're so articulate. You're so current. And anybody that can remember something from a 2004 show has my vote when you run for Congress.
Well, I'm enjoying being here, so thank you very much for having me.
Now, I read a poll the other day. The poll was done by University of Chicago. And they have a group there, I believe it's called the Nordic Pool, a Nordic Poll Group. They have some relationship with the Associated Press. I'm not sure what the legal relationship is. Anyway, they run polls all the time. Now, the last poll they ran had to do with something to do with executive order. And, of course, 85% of the Democrats that they polled were against Trump's executive order. And 70% of the Republicans were in favor of the executive order. What does that tell you as a critical thinking person?
Yeah, we poll everybody about everything, and it seems like every day we've got a new poll on the president's approval rating. And I don't know who's sinking all of this money into polling, but it's absurd, and it's really frustrating and troubling to me around election time, because we've gamified the elections. I know in many countries, you can't release poll results within a certain number of days or a certain number of weeks of the election. I would love to, not that it would ever stand up to constitutional muster.
We start releasing the polls, like one person votes, we start the poll.
It's absurd, and you know, It's very aggravating to me. It's very interesting to watch the polls move. You know, it seems like somebody sneezes and the polls move. It's very interesting, but it's very destructive. It's destructive to the way people watch politics. They're more interested in seeing poll numbers go up or down than they are in examining the things that are causing the poll numbers to go up and down. Then looking at the policies that folks are pushing out, they want to see, well, is my candidate winning or are they losing? Well, we're 3 months from the election. A lot can happen between now and then. Stop reading polls and start reading their policy positions. It's very, very aggravating to me that we just poll everybody about
everything. I just don't see how you can be a Democrat much longer because you have such good critical thinking skills, but you're the kind of person that we need to run for office, because maybe we need a whole new party and just call it the Critical Skill Thinking Party. And it's just people who don't want to be labeled Republican. I don't want to be labeled a Democrat, but I want to be in favor of certain important policies on education, on tax, and things of that nature. Okay, so that's great. I'm like you. I'm worried about the polls. I'm really worried about that people don't recognize that if the poll results are so partisan, if I already know if you're a Democrat that you're in favor of net neutrality, and I already know if you're Republican you're against it, there's something fundamentally wrong with that. It should be another level of information. As you said, the pollsters need to drill down on the real parameters that are causing the opinion, not the partisan politics.
And it's very easy to get the results that you want if you're not an above board pollster. Very easy to phrase the question in a specific way to skew results, and it's very frustrating to anybody that's paying attention.
Brian, you have been a fantastic guest. I hope that you would come on again. I hope that you would listen to my podcast and also continue to give me some good feedback, because I feel like your feedback is honest. It's not partisan. You're responding in what I call good thinking basis, which is what I consider myself. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I consider myself, not everybody agrees with me. I've got very close friends, by the way, who think I'm totally biased. I won't even mention their name. But my last question is Trump going to survive the next 4 years?
The short answer, yes, he's going to survive the next 4 years. I think there are a lot of folks on the far edges that think that there's really something there, some sort of collusion with the Russians that could lead to impeachment. I think we're really putting cart in front of horse, and, you know, let the investigation run its course. Let it be run by Mr. Mueller. Let him find that there either is some there or there isn't. I'm of the opinion that the Russians did try to influence the election. I don't know that they had that much of an effect. I think that Hillary Clinton was a deeply flawed candidate who shot herself in the foot time and time again and sort of handed the election to the president on a silver platter. But I don't think that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. I think the Russians tried to influence the campaign? Absolutely. Would they be fools not to? Absolutely. Do I think they manipulated the votes as they were being cast? No. Do I think that the president was sitting there in a smoke-filled room with Vladimir Putin trying to scheme a way to release bad press on Hillary Clinton? No. Hillary Clinton provided more than enough bad press by herself. She didn't need the Russians' help to have it released.
Would you agree that America, if any country, by the way, tries to influence another country's elections, that America is number one in that area?
You know, we are constantly influencing other countries' elections, and I don't say that as somebody who...
Well, we send the military in to influence them.
Yeah, I mean, well, we can look at the recent elections in France, right? So Barack Obama openly endorses Emmanuel Macron. Donald Trump doesn't officially endorse, but endorses Marine Le Pen. That's an attempt at influencing the election. That's absolutely an attempt at influencing the election. And yeah, we don't
that's overt.
That's overt. Yeah, that's overt influencing of the election. It's not manipulating votes. It's not anything that's under the table. It's not anything that's going to get Emmanuel Macron kicked out of office because he accepted the endorsement of the president, former president of the United States. But it's a very clear influencing of the election. So
we're in favor of we think it's okay to influence an election, but only if you do it above board and you don't do it clandestinely. If you just come out and if Putin would just come out and said, "Well, sure, I'm trying to influence the election. I don't want Clinton to get." Well, people would say, well, oh my gosh, that's wrong, but that's what we do. I understood that in one of the Israeli elections, we gave $150 million to an advertising company there to run ads against the person we didn't want to be elected. Now, I'm not saying that because we do it, it's okay if Russia does it. I am going back this whole notion of what I call hypocrisy. We shouldn't be surprised if Russia tries to influence the election, because why wouldn't they want to have somebody in they think will give them a better shake? What's wrong with that? That's the American way.
No, I happen to agree. Now, if evidence comes out that you know, folks were trying to hack election systems to manipulate votes, that's one thing. That's certainly crossing the line. That's certainly not an acceptable maneuver by any country, whether that's Russia, the United States, or anyone else. But if you're talking about releasing press coverage releasing stories that are seen as potentially negative against a candidate, that's hardly problematic. That's just to be expected. Now, if you have the Trump campaign sitting there feeding stories to the Russians, going, release this, release this, release this, that becomes problematic. Absolutely, that becomes problematic. But I don't think that's what was occurring.
Brian, I want to thank you very much. I hope that you would come back. The areas we just talked about are very interesting to me, and that is the issue of Russia collusion in America and maybe even Hillary Clinton. So I hope if you have some time in the next month, you'd agree to come back again and do another podcast, and let's explore some of those things in more detail. And my offer stands. When you run for office, I want you to send me a letter. I want to be your first donor.
Wonderful. I appreciate it. So I'd love to come back.
And that is going to be it. I brought to you courtesy of